Good morning, everybody.
Wow, that's all I get?
Good morning, everybody. Sorry.
Much better.
Yeah, just barely registered on the needle. Okay, it's day three, everyone.
Day three of four.
Day three of four. You all changed your tickets, right? Okay. So this is David Plum for people who are on the line. So we've got a good day. I'm not going to say a like jam-packed day because that's a little cliche, but we do have some really critical things we want to get through, and it's going to require an intensity of work today that will be similar, perhaps even a little more intense than in previous days. And I'm going to ask that, you know, we all contribute not only to that, but we have a little bit of patience and mercy with each other, with me. Gina had to go off and do another pre-scheduled thing, unfortunately, so I'm here solo at this point. So it's going to be an exciting day, and we're going to be moving in and out of working in smaller groups and here in the plenary. And that's going to be the spirit of the day, is really trying to nail down the things that we think we can make progress on face-to-face. Okay. I'm not going to go through a detailed agenda of what we're going to do today, but I'm going to say what the issues are that we're going to need to prioritize our time on today.
Pastor Benedict,
oh, right. what? Right. Goes around, comes around. Yeah. Okay. So, folks, the things that are going to be a priority for us today, we're going to take advantage of having some ICANN compliance folks with us right now this morning to talk about compliance, which is our purpose F, I believe, right? And we're going to ask the questions we want to ask of them so we can accelerate that work and work on that purpose. We're then going to listen to what the folks who have been looking at that legal basis question, the group that's been meeting upstairs, and we're going to hear about the logic that they've developed and the progress they've made. And then we're going to segue from that into having a shared group discussion right here in plenary about how we want to attack purpose B. Right? That's kind of been the elephant in the room that we left till today, in part to get better at using that data matrix. And we're going to get even better at it right now, hopefully with the contributions of that group that's been upstairs. And we're going to spend this morning on purpose B and making some progress on that. We've got a bunch of bits and bobs that we need to pull together as well in the afternoon around purpose N, making sure the group that did C was on the right track. There's the new purpose around research, ICANN research, that we need to tuck into, right? And we're going to look at our parking lot and figure out what we need to deal with on an in-person basis. There's a lot of folks who are interested in doing a quick take on legal versus natural persons, okay? So these are things that we're going to be scheduling up to deal with later in the day. But our priority for the morning, after we deal with compliance and getting a check-in from all the good work that's going on with the legal basis group, is to really dive into purpose B. Okay? Sound good? Now, we have, and just, Kurt, any more comments on that before we get going and diving in? Okay, great. So let's take advantage of the fact that we have some folks from ICANN Compliance, and I'll let you introduce yourselves because I've never met either of you. So we have someone on the phone. We have someone in the meeting with us now. And let me just frame it up to say, you know, Purpose F is about compliance, and so there's been a lot of interest in asking some questions of the compliance folks about the data elements that are important for their work and the other inputs that will help us tease out the results of this data matrix for Purpose F. Okay? So perhaps I'll let the two of you introduce yourselves, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Maggie Surad. I'm VP of Contractual Compliance, and with me I have Jennifer Scott, Senior Director of Contractual Compliance. We also have on the phone, I was happy that Jamie was able to join us, so I'm going to turn the mic to Jamie first. I'll do a brief summary, and then hopefully Jennifer will share a bit of examples, and then We are here. I hope you're not going to deal with us. I was worried when you said you're going to deal with us. I hope we are here to hear your questions. Yeah, I know. Some people are rubbing their hands. Yes, we are very popular in the ICANN community. I tell you, it's a tough job to meet everybody's expectation. So we will turn it then over to you to ask us questions. We are here to facilitate the dialogue with you, and we'll do our best to facilitate and support that. With that, Jamie?
Sure. Thank you. So this is I'm Jamie Hedlund. I'm head of contractual compliance and consumer safeguards, and we are happy to engage with you and support your important work now and at any time during the process. I only have a vague understanding of the questions, but my high-level understanding is that you are interested in understanding what data we need, contractual compliance needs, in order to enforce its the contracts and do the work that we do. As everyone there knows, we enforce, the contractual compliance department enforces the registry agreement, the registrar accreditation agreement. And in doing that, we are limited to the terms of those agreements. Those agreements spell out obligations for the contracted parties, and we enforce those either as a result of complaints or information from reporters, or as we audit the contracted parties and ensure that they are complying with their obligations. We need, in order to enforce the obligations, we need the data that's required for those obligations to be fulfilled. So it's a little circular, but if, for example, a registrant is supposed to wear a blue shirt when registering a .com domain name, we need data that shows that that person wore a blue shirt. If the RIAA does not require a registrant to provide a registrant's birth date, we are not going to, and we have no grounds to seek that out. So, up until May 25th, we had access to all the data that we needed in order to enforce each of the obligations of the contracts. As you all complete your work and those obligations change, then our need for data may change as well. We're not going to be in a position of saying whether or not a particular data element is or is not consistent with the GDPR. We don't enforce the GDPR. We enforce the temporary specification and eventually the policies that you develop as they get incorporated into the agreements. So I guess that's a long way of saying that we need the data that's required for the registries and registrars to comply with their obligations. And if it would be helpful later down the line, as those obligations become more clear, we can confirm, what data that we need. But with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Do you want us to continue and then do the Q&A at the end, or do you want to Q&A now?
Sure. I would say if there's some additional things, this is David Plum speaking, if there's some additional things you'd like to say, and in particular as it relates to how this group has been structuring its conversation, which is around, for instance, these data matrices that we've pulled up, that would be great. And then we can sort of go around and do a little Q&A.
Thank you, David. This is Maggie Surad. Continuing on with a little bit of an update, what Jamie shared with the team, since the 25th of May, what we have been doing in contractual compliance, as you might have seen the blog, is we are enforcing the temporary specification. And the way we have approached it, as you know, we do have complaints from external parties, but we also conduct internal monitoring or proactive monitoring activities. We have not created a new process or approach. We still follow the same compliance approach and methodology. We have not created a specific complaint type that says temp spec complaint type, because as you know, the temporary specification touches on many aspects of the agreement. So what we have been seeing is we're receiving complaints in the different complaint types. For example, if it's a whois complaint or a transfer complaint, and we deal with each complaint type, one on a case-by-case situation. The other thing I want to share with the team is, yes, we have adjusted our approach. You heard Jamie speak. We used to have access, so that the whole community used to have access to full whois records or full registration data. In light of the change due to GDPR, our way of enforcing the temporary specification is we review what's stated in there, and we will adjust our ask of the contracted parties or the reporters based on the case we are dealing with. To date, I am happy to share that, yes, we do get some pushback sometimes when we are dealing or investigating or reviewing, but when we explain what we are trying to resolve, we are seeing collaboration from the contracted party to provide the information. With that, I'm going to ask Jennifer to share briefly how that has changed, what I mean by we have adjusted our review, to share probably an example of two, and it will tie into the table that you have built here for yourselves.
Thanks, Maggie. This is Jennifer Scott, Senior Director of Contractual Compliance. So the whois inaccuracy complaint type is one of our largest volumes of complaint types. We're now seeing a lot of end users of the Internet as well as registrants who just don't understand where the whois went. So it's not as much of an inaccuracy complaint as it is effort in educating them about the redactions that the temp spec has now asked certain registrars to implement. But conceivably, and looking forward to addressing this purpose, conceivably those folks who would still get access to underlying or unredacted data could still have legitimate whois inaccuracy complaints. So what data compliance will need to address that will be on a case-by-case basis depending on what that complaint or what data elements that complaint is about. There's other complaint types, so like a transfer complaint type, you know, we have to ensure that if someone has requested an inter-registrar transfer, that that person is a transfer contact. So matching up their name and their email address for that type of complaint is essential. Same with domain renewal and redemption issues. If the registrar has complied with those obligations of sending renewal reminder notices to the correct contact, we would need to be able to see that contact. In the current state of things, we're asking the registrar just to confirm that information, but we have no external validation source. You know, it's just on the honor system right now. But before the 25th of May, we were able to see that in the public whois and confirm, and if there was any discrepancy, follow up on that.
Okay. Great. Anything else that you all would like to share before we just open it up and make some questions? Okay. So I see some hands up, Thomas, Alan, and then just start throwing up your stuff, and we'll build a queue here. And again, think about this as our great opportunity, almost in real time, to be working through this sheet with these resource folks right in the room with us. So, Thomas?
Thanks, Dave, and this is Thomas for the record. Thanks so much for joining us today. So basically what we're trying to establish here, how the flow of data in the GTLD ecosystem can be made lawful or can be made compliant. And we have little insight into as to what personal data you are processing in the course of your activities. Because we want to make sure that what we're doing does not impair your work, and that we adequately adjust retention periods, what data can be kept for, how long, for what purpose, so that we can bake that into our documentation. And GDPR is all about documentation for the most part. So if you could maybe speak a little bit to whether you process registration data processing would be if you get it, if you alter it, if you send it on. You know, do you get any of that data? If so, from whom do you get it? What do you do with it? Do you pass it on to third party? And how long do you keep it in your system? And if there's different treatment of personal data for different types of actions that you take, that would be great. And if this is maybe too complicated to answer on the spot, you know, GDPR requires those who are subject to GDPR to have a so-called record of processing activities that needs to detail all those actions. So if in the course of your GDPR compliance work, if you've already established such record of processing activities, it would be great if you could share that with this group. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas, for the specific questions you've asked of us. Maybe it would be helpful to share with you a bit of a day in the life of a complaint that will address what we receive, how we receive it, and something of that nature. Jennifer, do you want to?
So when we receive a complaint, we often do a follow-up with the complaint reporter and ask them for information to support their complaint. That usually contains personal data, usually their own, and that stays in our secure ticketing system that we have here at ICANN. Whether or not we share that with any third parties or other entities will depend on whether or not the complaint reporter provides their permission for us to do that. So we typically don't share anything that's been provided to us other than the original complaint summary, unless there's specific permission for other attachments or data that they've shared beyond the original summary to us. Now, that original summary does contain personal data in it, name, email address, sometimes phone number, sometimes postal address. We're looking at ways at streamlining what we ask for in that regard. And there's also an option for reporters to request to remain anonymous so that if we are addressing their complaint with a contracted party, their personal data is not included in that. So really it depends on what the reporter's preference is in terms of sharing and how much they want to provide us and allow us to share with others. When we do ask for the permission for sharing, we make it a broad ask, and we say registrar, registry operator, or any other entity that's necessary to address your complaint with. But typically that's limited to just a registrar for that domain name, or if it's a registry issue, that registry operator. There's not too many cases that I can think of where we're sending that data to somebody else other than that. Now, what they do with it, you know, that's on them. They might ask their back-end provider to look at it, a reseller. But because our contracts are limited to the contracted parties, registrars and registries, that's who we usually limit our conversations and communications with. In terms of retention, you know, that's something we need to look at because right now it stays in that secure ticketing system. You know, we can't control how long it takes a reporter to come to us with a complaint. They might sit on it, you know, 2 years after their domain name has expired or been transferred or subject to a UDRP. And so we never know how long or timely a complaint might be according to the situation that the domain name or whatever is being complained about is in. So it could be that, you know, documents that we're asking for might be quite old or stale. And if we're setting data retention policies around this, then it might just be too bad you waited too long. And that's what we have to tell the reporter if that happens. Is there anything else that I've missed or that you want me to address?
May a quick follow-up. Is there any personal data that you request from the registries and registrars? Because that's primarily what we have to deal with here.
So, like I was saying before, for instance, on the renewal complaints, we would ask, you know, did you send a registrar? Did you send the renewal reminders to the registrant and give us that information? So we do ask for that, you know, and who is. Right now we're asking for information if it was changed, from what it was previously to maybe now, if there's an issue with verification or inaccuracy or anything like that. So we will get data elements from the who is related to that. So there's quite a few complaints that we will need to ask for data from the registrars and registries for. And looking at the list that you've got up here in the purpose document, it's really a case-by-case situation, I wasn't quite sure what the ones and the dashes meant, but if we're going by the ones meaning something that the compliance could potentially need, that would be right.
Let's move through. I've got like 12 people in the queue. Alan and then Margie. Alan.
Thank you very much. A multi-part question, unfortunately, but they're linked together. They're all parts of the same thing. We're talking to compliance here, but as a result of the last WHOIS review, the first WHOIS review team, there is an accuracy reporting system, which is not run by compliance. It's run by another part of ICANN. The output from it is then fed into compliance. That the accuracy reporting system looks at a sampling of 12,000 domains every quarter, I think. Quarter? Half? Something. Every periodically. Currently, as of May 25th, they only have access to public data. So essentially, the whole accuracy reporting system is dead because to a large extent, they have no more access to data anymore. So that's a problem that I think we need to think about. So it's not just compliance access to data, but I can access the data for other parts of what we're doing. And the accuracy reporting system is linked to the 2013 RAA also. However, when that data then goes to compliance, the current numbers we're seeing are out of the 12,000 sampling. The accuracy reporting system tends to report something between 40% and 50% of them have a problem. I think that's the number. I may be out by it in the last significant digit. That's a rather startling number, but that's not our business here. Compliance, and if I understand correctly, and I'm meeting with Maggie tomorrow on this, by the way. My story is not quite straight. Maggie can probably provide more. Compliance then handles those four to seven thousand tickets that they get from the accuracy reporting system and verifies each of them to see is there indeed a problem. I take it right now, if I don't know if you had an ARS report since May 25th or not, but I presume when you get these N thousand tickets, you will now have to make N thousand queries of the registrars or registries to see what the data looks like now to verify whether there is still a problem or not. Am I correct in that? If indeed that is the answer, that sounds like an absolutely huge increase in workload and the amount of effort associated with handling each of these queries. So that's the first question.
Can we leave it there? Yeah.
Yeah. Just the second part of it either is there or is not there, depending on the answer.
Thank you, Alan. Yes, look forward to our meeting tomorrow. So the WHOIS ARS reporting system was a review team recommendation that was approved by the board, where ICANN had to proactively take action into ensuring that the WHOIS registration data is cleaner. Part of the internal reviews that ICANN is conducting is also a review of the WHOIS ARS. But to specifically answer some of the questions, if I forget some of it, please. I know you will remind me. Not please remind me. I know you will. The percentage of closed before first notice that you're referring to, no? Okay.
I was just referring to the number that gets sent to you as problematic.
Yes.
Not whether you close them or not depends on your judgment, but
yes,
you have to ask for the data to get to make that judgment.
So, yes, the WHOIS ARS system, the way it's been working. Now, of course, many things have to be adjusted since the temporary specification. But the way it has been working to date is that we receive specific records with specific issues. I want to make sure that the team understands that. If the issue is about a telephone number, or it's about an address or a zip code or specific issue, we are not looking at a holistic view of the record. We have now put a bit of a hold on the processing of voice ARS records because we are reviewing all these records and what is the impact on compliance, but also in relation to the temporary specification. But the practice has been is that you focus on that issue, you look at the WHOIS record that's currently available, if it's still available, and you address a specific issue. If it's redacted, then we have to, like I said, we have adjusted our review. And you heard Jennifer say, has it changed or something? But I want to assure the team that that effort at this point is on hold because we've got a lot of questions and a lot of other activities on an external complaint level that we're trying to work through.
The short answer is if you were to start processing them again, you would have to make queries to the registrar for each of those to be able to verify whether the data has changed or not.
For the non-public data, Alan, that's correct.
All Hewitt accuracy complaints are all non-public data now. Well, in some cases they may be if the registrar has chosen to still make the information available, it may still be available, but not in all cases. Yeah. Thank you. That's all I have.
Great. Thanks. Margie?
I think I'd like to, I have a lot of questions, but I think in particular I want to focus in on access. What kind of complaints are you receiving related to availability of access to the non-public data when requests are made? From the Facebook perspective, I can tell you that we've made approximately 9,000 requests, and we're seeing a very low response rate. We're seeing 55% where there's no response at all from the registrar.
Hey, Margie, this is Jamie. Can I just interrupt for a second? My understanding of this meeting is to talk about what data we would need and enforcing the agreements going forward. It's not about the temporary specification or what's required or not required to be provided now. And as I'm sure all of you can appreciate, we're not going to be in a position to talk about any ongoing investigations or complaints.
And Jamie, I'm not talking about a specific complaint. I'm just talking about generalities, and part of what this EPDP will do is talk about access at some point after we get through some of the purpose issues. So we could certainly talk about that later, but I would like to make a formal request to the compliance team to talk about that when we get to that part of our conversation. So maybe it would be in Barcelona.
Okay. Great. Okay. Noted on that, Margie.
Sure.
Thanks.
I still have other questions that relate to the topic. So tell me about the UDRP-related purposes and whether you're seeing any issues related to the UDRP and access to data as it pertains to a UDRP. So for example, if someone has anyone complained that they haven't been able to access the WHOIS data for a UDRP, and what kind of data do you request when you receive a complaint like that?
But again, Margie, you're asking about what's happening under the current temporary specification, correct?
No, I'm talking about the data that compliance needs in order to process a complaint related to the UDRP as it relates to WHOIS.
Right, under the current agreements.
No,
the current agreements spell out. Okay, so you're asking about that, right? Again, I mean, I guess it would be helpful to understand whether you're asking us about the temporary specification or you're asking us what's the policy, you know, what would be required under the policy that you all are working on, for the UDRP.
We're working on access to data that compliance needs in order to do the compliance function. So I'm just asking what kind of, do you access the WHOIS data for that purpose so that we ensure that we have the proper definition of it in our work?
This is Jennifer Scott again. So pre-temp spec, let me back up. The UDRP complaint type with compliance is related to complaints about implementation or not of a UDRP decision. So it's not typically something we would get a complaint about from a potential UDRP complainant who's trying to get information about a domain name and its who is. So those complaints aren't showing up. Post-temp spec, I believe the change to the UDRP is that registrars have to provide the full data to the providers. So we have had a couple of instances of complaints from providers where they haven't been able to access the full who is. Those are, you know, things that we can address with the registrar under the temp spec. But in terms of what information we would ask for once a decision gets to the point of being made by the UDRP panel and then we get a complaint about its implementation, we would need to see the who is to see if the decision has been implemented, you know, who the domain name is with in terms of the registrant, and if a transfer, or if that's what the decision is, has been made.
And the other question I have is, could you explain the interactions between the party that complains on a who is inaccuracy and compliance? So, for example, let me walk you through this. If someone makes a complaint with respect to a particular domain name that the who is inaccurate, and then you go back to the registrar and you and do your investigation, when you close the investigation or when you follow, how do you follow up with the third party that actually submitted the complaint?
Yeah, so the complaint reporter who's filed the complaint with ICANN compliance, it's treated like any other complaint type reporter. You know, we get their information when they submit their original complaint to us, and we use that information to communicate with them throughout the processing of the ticket. You know, registrar information is through what we call our radar system right now as the ICANN contact information for registrars. But all of the information that we use is provided to us through the complaint form. We don't generally use any additional information. So, for instance, if the complaint form's information differs from what is in the who is, we wouldn't reach out to the information that's in the who is unless it was also part of the complaint form.
Well, I think what I'm asking is once the information is received from the registrar, so if it's an inaccurate who is record, and if we've made a complaint that there's an inaccurate who is record, is there a point where compliance would respond back to the complainant and say the who is record information is this, and it would give you, you know. So in other words, for the specific complaint, does the who is data get as part of the response?
So pre-temp spec, it was there, right? We didn't have to share it. They could go see it as a public who is query. Post-temp spec, we do not share information that's been provided from registrars or registry operators through the complaint ticket processing process unless it's something that they've specifically given permission for us to share with other parties. So we can tell the reporter that information has been updated, but then they would have to go through the process of requesting access to be able to see that themselves.
Thanks, Margie. This is Kurt. I just want to support the point Jamie made, and that is what we need as our first inquiry is to know which data that compliance requires and why, so that we can fill out the rest of this form here and justify or you know, provide justification for that data or question compliance again. So I think our approach here is to hone that question as we go around the room and any specifics you need around that question. And then once we understand which data is needed and why, then we can flesh out with additional questions for compliance as a next step. So I'd like, as we go around the room, to really focus on, you know, what data elements are needed and, you know, how you might better ask compliance that question in an effort to get around the room a little faster. So, Milton, you're next in the queue.
That was exactly the point that I was going to make, Kurt, was that obviously the change from open to redacted who is going to dramatically change the whole who is accuracy equation. in two ways. Number one, there would be less incentive to be inaccurate because it wouldn't be public. And secondly, there would be no random automated challenges coming from people who are just scanning that Whois data and looking for domains to take. But what I'm curious about in this exercise is what data does compliance need that they're not already getting? When I think about it, I think mostly of compliance as being a disclosure issue. That is, when do you need to see data that's already been collected? But then Jamie's blue shirt comment was a very good way of highlighting the issue of collection. So if indeed a registry has as part of its contract that you have to be wearing a blue shirt at the time of registration to register in this domain, then obviously you would need to collect data about that. And since every registry might have completely different requirements, I'm seeing a somewhat disturbing open-ended collection mandate there, which I'm not sure how we would handle. Could we view compliance in purely terms of disclosure, or do we really need to collect new data, certainly at the ICANN level? I'm curious as to what you would do with the diversity of registry requirements if you're talking about enforcing, you know, what we used to be talking about under N, right?
So this is Jamie Moulton. If I could just start, and then Jen and Maggie chime in when I go astray. But all that I meant was that there are obligations under the agreements for the registries and registrars to collect certain data. They don't need to disclose that to us unless and until there is either a compliance action or an audit. So we're not asking them to collect, you know, the data on the registrant and immediately disclose it to us. They do have to obviously escrow the data as well. So I don't know. So we're not in terms of the different registry and registrar requirements that they may have. We are not enforcing whatever requirements or looking at their different requirements to operate as a going concern. We are simply trying to ensure that they're complying with the agreement's obligations.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie.
Well, I'd like to add one more thing. This is Maggie. You heard Jennifer describe the operation aspect of the external complaints and how data is dealt with. For this team, you also know we do proactive monitoring in the form of contractual compliance audits. To emphasize on that one, the data we in the audit that we request from the contracted parties, once we complete an audit program and there are no deficiencies, we remove the data. So it is not kept in our systems because there's one purpose in the audit program that we address it and we close it once the audit program is closed or when the remediation is completed by a contracted party. Just want to make sure that the team understands that. It's a little bit different approach than operational.
Thanks. Alex, and let's test out how brief we can be, knowing that we've got gobs of work to do today. So let's really try to be brief. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Maggie. And this is Alex Deacon from the IPC. I want to make sure I understand how compliance is doing their job in the temp spec world in order to fill out this worksheet that we're working on. So let me do a quick day in the life of someone who would be doing an IP investigation, and I'm going to ask a specific question, but just bear with me for a second. So let's assume that I'm asking for a registrar for non-redacted Whois information based on legitimate interests, an IP infringement, for example. The registrar receives my requests and does what they do to prove that it's a legitimate request and it's balanced with the rights of the registered name holder. And because of that, they return the non-public Whois data to me. So that's great. I get this data and realize that it's inaccurate. Right? It's Mickey Mouse, or it's the address is clearly inaccurate or the phone number is zeros or something like that. And then I would go ahead, because now that I have access to the non-public who is information and have determined that it's inaccurate, I file an inaccuracy complaint with compliance. What do you do at that point? What are you requesting from the registrar to get that information for that specific domain? And I guess it's just not clear to me from this conversation exactly what the process is from the compliance team at that point in a world where non-public who is where who is now redacted.
Jennifer, so in that situation, we would ask for evidence supporting the inaccuracy claim. So if it's a postal address, maybe a returned letter. If it's an email address,
you would ask me for that information. Okay, and then I would provide that to you, and then what would you do?
And then that's when we would forward your complaint on to the registrar to have them address it. And if that resulted in an update to the non-public who is, they would provide that information to us to support that
and correction. So they wouldn't provide you with the data. They would provide you with an indication that the data has been updated.
So we do ask for evidence of the update. Whether or not we're getting it is a different story because under the temp spec, we feel like it's something we should ask for because we do like to have evidence to support
right. The
registrar's responses.
Okay, so in terms of us filling out this form, and hopefully you could validate once we've got through it, because you guys are the compliance experts and this is all about you guys, there are cases where you will need access to this data, and we need to ensure that there's a policy set that's legal and compliant with GDPR that allows you to do that, and you get access when required. Okay, thank you.
Great. I'm going to jump to Christina, who is next on my queue. Georgios, I had you up, but your thing went down. You all set? Okay.
No.
Yeah, but sorry, I got Christina, Benedict, Mark, S., and then Ashley. Sorry.
Christina Rosette, Registry Stakeholders Group. I have two questions, and I'll pose them both. One of them is somewhat related to the question that Milton posed, following up on Purpose N, which covers enabling validation of registered nameholder satisfaction of registration policy eligibility criteria. And I think what would be helpful for us to understand is does compliance only audit that the registry operator's collection of data elements that would demonstrate the registered nameholder satisfaction where they're in connection with specifications 11 through 13, or is it also in connection with a registry operator that may have outside of 11 through 13 have decided to adopt for its own business model an additional registration policy eligibility requirement? Question number one. And question number two is one of the things that we were talking about yesterday in the group that was discussing the dispute resolution policies was the question came up is the circumstances in which compliance would contact a registry operator in connection with a UDRP decision where the registrar was failing to implement. And does that happen? And if so, what data elements does compliance expect that the registry operator will be able to – will have in order to act on whatever the compliance request is? Thanks.
This is Jennifer. I'll take your second question first. On the UDRP, we don't typically contact registry operators. If the registrar has failed to implement a decision or follow the UDRP rules and procedure, that's on the registrar to demonstrate compliance with that. So that would follow the normal enforcement process for that registrar. For your first question, I might need some clarification. I think you're asking about if we're auditing collection for data elements that would fall under Spec 11 through 13, but if you can elaborate on that.
Sure. So one of the purposes that the registry's put forward in terms of our broader discussion of purposes is to enable a registry operator or a registrar to validate that a registered name holder has satisfied whatever registration policy eligibility criteria might apply in a particular TLD. So in order to make sure that we're accounting for whatever data elements compliance may need, we wanted to have a, it's, I think, important for us to understand when compliance is conducting audits of the registry, of the satisfaction of those, is compliance limiting its audit scope to just any registration policy eligibility requirements that might be in specs 11 through 13, or do they also include kind of beyond that that a registry operator might adopt? And if so, in either scenario, what data elements are you expecting to see as part of the audit?
Okay, thanks for that clarification. So the scope of our audits or operational questions is limited to what's in the contract. So if the registry operator has implemented additional registration policies that require other elements, you know, that might come into play if they mention it, but it's not something that we could hold them to demonstrating compliance with because that's out of our scope.
Great. Thanks. Benedict?
Hi, Maggie. Can you just help me with one thing I haven't really understood so far? Does compliance use Whois data internally at the moment?
So the question is, do we use Whois data?
At all.
Yes, we use Whois data when we are reviewing external complaints based on the cases that we receive, but we also may use it in the audit when we are testing for compliance-related matters.
Thank you. So you've answered my second question, which is what do you use it for? Third question, how long do you keep that for, please? Or how long do you want to keep it for?
I cannot answer how long do I want to keep it for. It's going to depend on the data retention. Today there are certain requirements in the contract about data retention, or there are some contracted parties that have brought forward some of their local reasons for data retention to be changed. So we follow and apply that. But from an audit perspective, I said earlier, we do not keep the data past an audit that has what we call a clean report. If a contracted party has a remediation plan that is, well, I don't know, a month duration or 3 months duration because of the complexity of whatever it is they are trying to remediate, if it's a system or rolling out tools or something, we follow through, we keep the data, because that's our means to compare at the end of the remediation to see have they corrected that issue, and we request a revision of these data that we were testing for. But again, once an audit report has been cleaned, we do get rid of the data.
Just to be clear, what we're looking to do is help you. You're not obliged to delete data immediately. You're allowed to retain it for as long as you can justify that. So one of the things we're doing in this exercise is try to work out what looks like reasonable. Is that 10 days or is that 2 years? So it would really help us, and we're not trying to catch you out here, to understand how long, what sort of time ranges you look at.
Thank you, Benedict. It's difficult to put a time range. As you all know, you may have been reporters in the complaint system to ICANN. We have reporters who file a complaint. We go back to them and ask for additional data, and we do not hear from them. They resurface a year later. Hey, you know, we close those complaints, and if the requirement is do not keep data beyond a year, then that would be our response. If we don't have it, we cannot resolve or assist in resolution. So for those who respond timely and provide information, we are able to assist with. Now, there may be different scenarios where data is being presented for a legal purpose or something. I cannot predict what that might be. I think Jamie stated it best at the beginning, and Jennifer earlier on today, is that we do follow what is in the contract, and if we try our best to help resolve and facilitate that resolution, but we also are limited by whatever the environment is dictating. So I cannot tell you if it's 5 years, 2 years, 6 months. You know, it's you guys are more familiar with what cases you might be seeing.
Great. So, Ashley?
Thank you. This is Ashley representing the GAC. Benedict essentially asked my question, but I have a follow-on to it. So it sounds like you get requests years after the registration period has ended. But in terms of helping try to quantify what data retention period would be helpful, do you track the number of complaints that you get? And in terms of, like, would you be able to identify, like, is there a significant number of complaints that are filed a year after or 2 years after that would really warrant a data retention period that is a certain time period?
Thank you, Ashley, for the question. This is Maggie. We do not track on that data element that you specifically asked for.
So I'm just checking, Alan. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, just a small follow-up on that. We do track, though, the total from receipt to closed, and sometimes we're in a period of remediation with a contracted party. That might take some time for them to do things like update systems and implement new ways of doing things to be in compliance with the contractual obligations. You know, it's rare that we have a complaint open that's been open a year, but that data might be able to help us at least predict, you know, what some of the longest complaints open are to be able to know whether or not they would need to retain data, at least during the processing of the complaint itself, and same for our retention as well.
And if possible, could you share the statistics of that data? And bearing in mind, we're just talking about retention for your purposes. You're not obliged to keep data for 10 years in case someone happens to need it. That's their problem. That's their, what we describe as purpose, not your purpose. We're just trying to understand your purpose and your compliance needs to retain data, because you're not allowed to keep beyond that under the rules. So we'd be really helpful if we could just understand roughly the are you able to share that sort of length of complaint data to inform our work?
Sorry, we're trying to understand. Ashley, can you repeat your question one more time? Because we went around a big circle with this answer.
Yes, and to Ashley, representing the GAC, just to be clear, I'm not talking only, it's not only limited to ICANN's retention. I'm talking about retention of data by the registrars as well. In terms of being able to help us determine data retention, trying to put together some data points here, are you able to quantify how many complaint requests you all get that are in a certain time frame? Like you get within a year you get 150 complaints, that's probably totally way out there, that are a year after the life of the actual registration. So basically, for you to follow up with that complaint, you have to have access to data that is retained. So we're trying to figure out what the data retention period is, but it's hard to do that without something to point to. Thanks.
Thank you. The answer, no, we do not keep that data element.
Okay, guys, that seemed to open up a bunch of questions. I'm just conscious of time. Let's, for the final questions, let's see if we can drive this home. The final things are going to help us later this afternoon fill out this sheet. All right, so I know that, Mark, you put your thing up, so let's go Mark, and then Thomas.
Sorry, this is Jamie. Can I just go back to Ashley's question really quickly? I think there are two things going on here. One is how long should registries and registrars hold on to data? How long, you know, in case there's a complaint? And then secondly, how long should compliance hold on to data that it gets and it compiles or gets as a result of complaints or audits. Those are two different things, and it would be helpful, I think, to get more precise questions about what kind of data and what instances in order for us to be able to respond appropriately. But we're happy to work with anybody on nailing that down.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. I think that was super helpful clarification, folks. Let's be really clear what we're talking about, right? So compliance folks have said after a complaint is successfully closed or the clean closed, you delete your data. And then Ashley's question is about data that registrars. No. Okay. Sorry.
The statement you just made applies to audits, not to external complaints that are filed in the system.
Mark, Thomas?
Mark SV for the record. This is a question for Dan, actually. Given that this data is being processed by more than one organization in ICANN, and there's a lot of details that were asked here, I think those details could have been addressed if there were a data privacy impact assessment that was available to us to review. And so my question is, will you be creating a data privacy impact assessment related to these topics, and will we be able to review them?
Thanks, Dan Halloran. We have not done a data privacy impact assessment. It's been discussed several times. We've never been directed to do one, and we've looked at it and haven't seen a requirement to do one, but I guess we're open to the possibility that one might be done.
Yeah, I think given that you are holding data for a period that you should strongly consider doing one.
Thanks, Mark. Mark A.?
Thanks. Mark Anderson for the transcript, and thank you, Margie, Jen, Jamie, for joining us. A couple follow-ups. As I've been sitting here, I've been trying to take everything we've been talking and relate it back to our work, the work we're doing trying to develop policy recommendations here and how that relates to compliance. I guess, one comment, I think as far as the retention of data received from compliance, I think that's outside of our scope, right? I think we're concerned with the retention of registration data. And I think really the retention of that data beyond the life of the registration. So obviously that data is going to exist during the registration. I think the question is how long after the life of the registration does that need to be retained? So just trying to focus that question a little bit. And then if I can tease out some of the conversations we've been having, there seems to be sort of two processing maybe not the right word, but bear with me there. It seems to be two sort of processing activities that occur related to compliance. One is audit, which you've mentioned. So there's an audit that occurs. And the other is sort of compliance activity initiated as a result of a reporter. And so in each of those cases, I think we need to understand what is the personal data being processed, and how that's being used. I think that's where where our focus is of the group is what are the processing activities for this registration data directory services related to compliance. And what policies do we need in order to be GDPR compliant and enable compliance to do their work? So I hope I summed up where we are adequately, but I guess with that, that was more of a statement than a question, but with that, I guess the question is back to compliance. Where are you processing personal data in these two activities, audit or compliance activity as the result of a third-party requester?
Mark, thank you for the question. This is Maggie. The last one, did you say where are we processing? I didn't understand.
Sorry, I guess where was probably an imprecise word. First, can you confirm that I've got that right as far as the processing activities, and sort of what are the what are the things, what are the things you need to be able to do, to complete your tasks related to those two activities, and specifically, where does that touch on personal data? Because I think, as we're talking about GDPR, right, the personal data is where, we need to be concerned with making sure it's justified under GDPR.
Thank you, Mark A., for the record. This is Maggie. So the simple answer to this is the process and the approach for audits or external complaints or proactive monitoring or external complaints is the same process that's published on our website and the approach. For external complaints, it's a simpler approach because it is focused on a specific complaint, as you heard Jennifer speak to it, whether it's a transfer order who is inaccuracy or different aspects of complaints received. For audit, it's the same, but we do a more approach. For example, if it's a full audit of the agreement and the policies that we're launching, or if it's a focused audit, the data we look for is very similar. If we are testing, if a registrar is sending renewal notices, the same as if you are looking at a renewal ticket, we look for the data that's there to support the evidence and to support either the resolution or to look at giving them a clean test of that audit. So from that approach, it's pretty much the same. It's just the scope that determines the ask and what we do.
Thank you. If I could follow up just real quick,
super quick, because we really need to wrap up. And we could carry this off into another conversation or give some tasks. Maybe they can give some written comments on the back end of this.
Yeah, but understood, but I'm trying to bring this back to our work. That was useful, but I'm not sure, from that answer, I'm not sure where the processing of personal data was.
So if I could try, this is Jamie. The processing of personal data comes where there is an obligation relating to personal data. If a registry or registrar has an obligation related to personal data of a registrant, we need to be able to confirm that that personal data was collected or whatever per the terms of the contract. We're not going after personal data because it's personal data or because we want personal data. It is tied to an obligation in the agreement. So if there's an obligation in the agreement for a registrar to collect personal data, then whether it's a result of a WHOIS complaint, WHOIS inaccuracy, or an audit, we need to be able to confirm that they collected that personal data. Does that help?
Thanks, Jamie. There's just a sidebar going on right now. Mark, last chance, you want to say something? Then we have Thomas, we've got Caboose, and Ashley. Okay, Thomas?
Yeah, I think you made an excellent point that we need to take stock and probably ask you to get back to us in writing so that we're clear on what you're doing. Let me try to frame exactly what our requirements are to be able to do our work. Or maybe I should say what we don't need from you. If you're getting third-party complaints that you're working on, you're getting PII from the complainant and process that case, that has nothing to do with our work. So we're interested in the cases, maybe audits or individual complaints where you go to a contracted party and ask them to either offer access to or provide personal data. So if you tell them we have a complaint on this specific domain name, please send us a copy of the email that you sent to the customer or to the registrant. That would contain PII, and that's something that we would need to know, right? So you might have different compliance actions, WHOIS rectifications, or other stuff, renewal complaints. So maybe you can just specify in a heading, what the complaint is, what the type of complaint is, and what you then ask from the contracted party. And the same would be for audits, whether you ask the audit reports to contain personal data. And if so, how long, and I guess there's some confusion around the retention. Retention, the clock is not ticking as of the opening of the case, but for how long you want to retain it after the case is completed. Right? And that would be valuable for us to understand, because we need to find justifications for registries and registrars to send, transmit, or offer access to personal data for you. I hope that makes it clear.
So this is what I'd love to do. Let's take a couple more questions and then some final comments from you all, and then perhaps we can follow up with some written material, okay? We have Cavus.
Excuse me. Good morning to you in Los Angeles. If you allow me, I want to just make one question. It seems that there is a need to retain the data, but we don't know for how long. ICANN is not in a position to say for how long, because as they mentioned, it depends on case-by-case basis and circumstances. But during the last 20 years of life of ICANN, perhaps they could provide some sort of statistic, the minimum and maximum period that they faced to the case that they need to go and look at the data. They could provide that information. And the last issue that I mentioned, that is there any restricting or limiting factor that you could not retain the data more than certain period? It is a legal limitations, it is informatic limitations, or it is administrative limitations. Why you cannot retain the data beyond certain years? So what is it? But I think the statistic minimum and maximum would help. I don't think that this group would arrive at in a specific period, which is based on the valid argument that data should be retained for X year and Y year. The only thing they should have an estimate or guesstimate or average, something like this. And that is just for discussion in the group. Thank you very much for giving me the floor.
Thanks, Cavus. So, you know, Maggie and team, you know, there's a request to react to Cavus and to Thomas right now before we got two or three more comments. You want to have just a quick reaction to those?
No reaction, just a comment. Cavus, hey, retaining the data, I mean, the general comment that I want the team to keep in mind is that the list you have here, as Jennifer stated, the ones, these are all requirements by the agreement. We follow the agreement, we follow the policy, and on a case by case, if the policy is not stating that this information is required for a certain policy, whether it's a transfer or who is inaccuracy, we do not ask for it. We do not retain data outside of a specific case that we are dealing with. The data is limited to the case. We do not retain audit data once an audit is complete.
Okay. Yeah, there's a request, Thomas, just quickly, if you could, if there's a specific thing you'd like to hear from them right now, that's that, or maybe Benedict wants to articulate that for you, but I just, yeah, just quickly, and then I've got, you know, two more people, or three more people in the queue, and then we really should move on to the next thing. So quickly, Thomas, if there's something you want to hear from right now, this is a good chance.
No, I think if we get an email from you specifying what you get in the course of what compliance work, and if it's just a pointer to the respective policies, that would help us great.
Great. Ashley, is that for a fresh question? Okay, please.
Sorry, very quickly. So during the complaint and compliance process, you noted that you follow up with the party that the complaint is filed against to see that they've taken action. But do you, in that beyond just asking them, do you track changes within the WHOIS record? Like, do you? I mean, whether it's public or not, do you need to, like, do you confirm it as opposed to just asking them?
We would like to. In the current situation, we have to rely on them providing us either confirmation, if not the full data element that's changed. Pre 25 May, you know, we would use the public WHOIS as an external validation source, and we would like to be able to do that. You know, as honest as all contracted parties are, it's just a safer, close the loop type of situation to be able to see that record as well.
Hadia, and then I'll swing back to Mark. Hadia.
Hadia Minyawi, for the record. So this is a quick one. I don't know if it's appropriate to ask you to look at the data and confirm that you need all this data for your audit, or you don't. Is it okay to ask you to look at the data up there and
again, if it's case by case on what we need?
No, for your audit, so that's not case by case, right?
Well, it depends on
the full audit.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, yes. The other part of this is sometimes to be able to confirm data escrow is being deposited correctly. That would also require a full who is set to make sure that that's all there as well.
So basically what you're saying that all this data up there is required, right?
Right.
Generally speaking, yes.
Super. Okay. Mark, bring us home. Mark Anderson, do you want to ask anything? No. Okay. Kurt, any last words, Kurt?
Yeah, thank you very much, you guys, for showing up. So to put a point on it and to follow up on Hadia's last question and what Thomas asked, we need, in this policy we're creating, we're not just saying what we're going to do, but we need to say why, because it has to stand up to scrutiny. The legitimate interest you have in data has to stand up. So I think what we need from you is a writing describing what data you need for audits and why, and what data you need for complaints and why, so that we can put that legitimate interest in our document so it stands up to the scrutiny of others. So that's the sort of thing we need. And it doesn't have to be on a piece of data by piece of data. You know, you can group data to say, with this group of data we need for these purposes, so that we can. So that would give this group a prose to put into the policy to discuss, and then put into the policy, come back to you with questions or agree with that. Is that off base, Alan, or?
I was just going to say that what you're asking from compliance, we really should ask ICANN in general if any other parts of ICANN have similar needs. The ARS is an example. Just because we have identified compliance today, we want to make sure we're not forgetting some other critical part of the organization.
But to be clear, are you asking for a listing of data that we need to enforce the temporary specification, the original agreements, new policies that you may develop?
So I think ICANN, so I'm learning some of the lingo. So I think ICANN has a legitimate interest in the data in order to enforce its contracts and, you know, in line with its stability and security mission. So it's not in line with the temp spec. We're writing a policy that replaces the temp spec. So it's sort of a zero base analysis of what data you need so that it can be included.
All right, folks. So many thanks. Anything else that you all would like to say, Jamie or others, as we close this out? Any final comment?
Jamie, anything?
No, thank you. Just thank you all, and we are happy to have had this opportunity, and we'll look forward to working with you all in the future and getting this right. Thanks.
I just want to confirm. First of all, thank you. Welcome to LA. It's good to see you, everybody here. Good luck to all of us through this process. But the last ask is, please, let's submit those in writing. I tried to take notes, but don't assume I've captured the questions exactly. Once we receive that, we will do our best to provide. I like the approach that Kurt's proposing, more of a general approach, because I think I heard Thomas say, taking every policy and every agreement and every, that would, it's a huge effort to undertake. Okay. I may need to join this team. Thank you, and good stay for the rest of the week.
Many thanks. Great. Okay. So, Okay. So, our transition now is going to be going into looking at this work that's the folks who have been doing the
the changes around legal basis and what that can mean in terms of a slight modification of our matrix, and then working on B together for a little bit, and then splitting up. Margie, what's your comment?
Oh, it relates to the we were just talking about other uses that ICANN has. Can we invite someone from the security team, John Crane or David Conrad, to talk to us about similar thing, like what they use, how they use Whois in their process?
Okay, so can I suggest? Sure, Benedict.
Sorry, guys. So I queried ICANN.org, and I did this informal process. JJ, my understanding is that JJ has informed ICANN staff that they may not use registration data internally. That includes security. I put a question via Marika to Owen Smigielski on the 8th of September, asking about contractual compliance use of registration data. It'd be great if we could follow up on that one. So my understanding is no other part of ICANN gets that. Thank you.
But can we at least talk to them about it and find out what happened before, what happened now? Same conversation we've been having with compliance, because then we can at least ensure that our policy, you know, addresses it or doesn't address it, and we'll have a conversation about it.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I'm just going to be a little bit of a pain in the butt right now, which is we've got to move, right? And I wonder if something like that is well addressed through some questions that maybe – the two of you sit down and make sure we put the right questions and we put them out there, right? And that might be a more efficient way to get that information into analysis like that. Because trying to do that today, doing another hour and 15, whatever we just did, conversation, doesn't seem like the right way to move right now, guys. Okay? But let's not forget about it, Margie. Let's sit down maybe with those of you who care most, make sure you got the right questions, and then with the power of the whole group, maybe we can get a little bit faster response. Right, and Dan maybe can help us with that and others. Sound good? Okay, great. Okay, so we need to just like stand up for 1 second. I feel like let's just stand up for 1 second and like shake that off a little bit. Oh yeah. Okay. We're just standing up to get blood going. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. You guys want a break? Is there coffee out there? No, but there is a bathroom. Okay, so there's a 5-minute bio break. Let's do that. Let's try to be back. Right, so what time is it? It's 10 o'clock right now? Yeah, so we're back in our seats at 10:10, getting going. All right, folks, let's take 10 minutes back, or 5-10 minutes. We'll be back here at 10:10, and we'll get going. Thanks.
Okay. We're back. Okay, we're back. So, let me just give you a quick vision about what's about to happen. First, this smaller group that's been working on the issue of legal basis is going to give a quick update of where it's gotten to in terms of its logic for making those decisions of deciding between 6.1B or 6.1F, for instance. It's going to show an example of, about how it applies that logic to one of these purpose statements in a processing activity. Okay? Then we're going to pull up the matrix or the data element sheet for our dear friend, Purpose B, right? Our dear amalgamation of five purposes in one. And we're going to talk for a little bit amongst ourselves, all of us in plenary, about how we're going to use this data elements matrix to go through Purpose B, which has some complexities because it involves third-party interests and other things. Okay. And then we're going to work in parallel small groups on the same questions that we're going to decide how we're going to do it in the group. And we're going to work in parallel small groups for probably up until lunch or close to lunch, and then we're going to come back and we're going to see how we did in our groups in filling out our data elements matrix for Purpose B. That's what we're going to be doing for the rest of the morning. And we start, Thomas is going to be giving us this report back on how your group has been, that group upstairs has been doing, both in terms of the criteria for deciding on legitimate purpose or legal basis, excuse me, and then how to apply that. So, Thomas, I give you the floor.
Thanks very much, David. This is Thomas for the record. Now, the sub-team that's been working upstairs was quite efficient in getting the matrix to the next level because we thought or we established that some points were not obvious or they were obvious to Fazani and myself when we wrote it, but they were not obvious to everyone. So basically, the first thing that we added, and you will see that in a moment, and Caitlin, you don't have to change things in the Adobe for the moment, but there was some mismatch of how the processing activity, i.e. what is done to data elements, is connected to the purposes. So we added an additional field, or we renamed a field for a brief description of the processing activity, you know, collection of certain data elements or transfer of certain data elements, brief description. And also, and that goes back to the point that Stephanie made a couple of times, we discussed responsibilities, i.e. who is the controller, joint controller, or processor for certain processing activities. That you also find in 3. So we established a new 3A and 3B for that information. And that allows us to quite efficiently walk through the steps that are required to establish the lawfulness of a processing activity. So what we basically did, and Caitlin, I guess we need the little list that I've written up a moment ago. So the groups had issues at times making a distinction between 6.1b and 6.1f. So, and I'd like all of you to take a look at this and let me know if I'm on the wrong track here. But I think that the way the groups should conduct this, in addition to filling out the form, is, you know, start with describing the processing activity. So collection of data for the registrant by the registrar would be a description of the processing activity. Then you would say, what purpose does this relate to? Because we have the purposes in the upper section of the table, and that would be a typical A, you know, because that's a part of the data that we collect in order to entitle the registered name holder or to enable the registered name holder to exercise rights in a particular domain name. So we have the processing activity and the purpose. And then the question is, what is the legal basis for that? And the first question to be answered there is, in number 3 here, is the processing necessary I'm making it bold here because that's the key word. Is the processing necessary to perform the registration agreement, i.e. the contract between the registrar and the registrant? And then you take a two-step approach to make things, to keep things simple. First question is A, from a technical perspective. So we've established that, you know, in order to give the registered name holder the right in a domain name and make sure that we can always trace back who is the owner of a particular string, we'd say, yes, technically it's required to make that association. And then we can conclude at that point and say, okay, the collection of registrant data by the registrar is required to perform the contract, and then you have your 6.1b. Does that make sense? I hope. But there are other processing activities that, where it's not so obvious. These requirements come from ICANN in the RA or in the RAA. And there your test would be 3B. Is this based on a lawful ICANN requirement that that ICANN dumps on the registrar, and does that make its way into the registration agreement? Right? And a good example for that could be ICANN, or in the temporary specification, there's a requirement for the registrar to pass on data to the registry, registrant data to the registry. So the question, again, is, let's use that example, is that technically necessary to make a domain name registration available? The answer is likely not, right? Is it a lawful ICANN requirement to pass on that data to the registry to perform the contract? Is it necessary for that? Is it necessary to perform the contract? And then the answer is likely, well, not so much, right? So you would then say no for passing on the data, and you would move to number five. So we would then check 6.1f. And then the first question is a legitimate interest pursued? And ICANN has an interest in providing for the security and stability, and registries want to do checks on DNS abuse and all that. So we'd say, yeah, they have an interest in ensuring that all the data lands is with the registry. So the registries can assert that interest based on this ICANN requirement. Then you would say, is the processing necessary to achieve that? And the answer is also yes, because in a decentralized system, you can't do DNS abuse checks, because in a decentralized whois, you wouldn't be able to conduct checks for the whole zone. So you need it in one place. What are the interests of the data subject? The interests of the data subject are that the data is not compromised and stuff like that, but this would not include publication. So we can say, well, the interests of the data subject are not impaired by this data transfer because the data is kept under lock and key. And therefore, the balancing exercise in this regard would be in favor of the controller. So we could say that part of the transfer would be a typical 6.1f, a legitimate ICANN interest that's not outweighed by the rights of the data subject. Right, so we've now gone through one example, registration data collection by the registrar, where we'd have a perfect 6.1b, and the transfer between registrar and registry, which would be a perfect 6.1f. But let's take this one step further, and Christina will hopefully love this, because there might be cases where a registry has particular eligibility requirements, .abogado, .law. So they want to establish that only eligible registrants can get their domain name. The registry wants to conduct validation of the eligibility requirements. So the contract, the product offered to the registrant is slightly different. It's not just you get a domain name, but it is you get a domain name, we make sure that nobody or that everyone in the zone fulfills the eligibility criteria so that it's a particularly trusted zone that your domain name is registered in, right? And in that case, we see a change happening. There's an additional requirement that is required to perform the contract, and therefore, since the registry needs to conduct the validation, the passing on of data from the registrar to the registry becomes a 6.1b, right? So that is to give you an example of where the same processing activity in practical terms can pursue different processing purposes and can be justified according to two different legal bases. So that's something that you should go through as you conduct your checks of the spreadsheet. Last question is then, who is responsible for the processing activity? So you would say, is it ICANN as a controller, is it the registry as a controller, or is it the registrar as a controller? And for example, for the collection of registration data by the registrar, we've established that this is a joint interest of ICANN registries and registrars, so they would be joint controllers in that instance. And so our group, I think in a matter of 75 minutes or so in total, we've been able to establish this for, I think, 4 or 5 sheets. So, you know, that can go relatively quickly. We will try to work I will try to roam between sub-teams and answer questions, should there be any, but this is basically what you're about to do when you populate the additional data matrices.
Yeah, why don't we show up what the new question 3 looks like on the data matrix so people can and see what that looks like.
And some of what you find here is already on the spreadsheet. I just wanted to give you to share my thought process with you. You see a new 3A and a new 3B. We scroll down a little bit. You know, that's the description of the processing activity and the addition of the responsible parties. So that we would have Lindsay's point, you know, addressed to spell out what the concrete processing activity is, and Stephanie's point about responsibilities as well. Thank you.
Okay, so we can have a quick conversation about this. I think the real takeaway, at least for me in helping all of you have these conversations, is that what this group has done is added that conversation about, let's talk about the specific processing activity or activities that are part of this purpose. Right, Thomas? Let's talk about that, and let's do that analysis against how it relates to that contract and the service between the registrant and the registrar, and that'll help us answer this one. Great. So I see a couple. Let's go quickly around here. Alan, and then Georgios, and then
Thank you. I know this is a very ICANN-centric discussion, but there may be some edge cases, and the case of data to validate special registry criteria, I don't believe we are a controller at all. I believe the registry is the controller. We may have to have processing access and rights to be able to validate the contract, but that data is solely under their control, and I don't think shows should show up on our records at all from the point of view of what we're presenting. They're the one who invented that data. They control it, and they have to give us access for contract auditing and or complaint handling. But so I think we have to be careful as we're going forward, not treat everything as ICANN data if it really isn't ours or really isn't us specifying it.
You want to just jump on that real quick?
We had that discussion in the breakout team, and the response that the group came up with was that ICANN enforces those. ICANN might enforce PICS and other criteria, so it can be an ICANN requirement. But it doesn't have to be, and we don't need to do a back and forth here. I think it's just a matter of proper documentation. There are many things that you can do this way or the other, but we need to come up with a plausible way of explaining things and justifying things.
Just to follow on, it does mean that we have to, if we decide to look at it that way, we have to make sure the registry lists us as a processor and has a third-party interest.
No, they could still be joint controllers. But let's not go into that level of detail.
Great. Georgios.
So Georgios Talantis from the GAC. Just to add to what to Thomas' presentation, despite the fact that also in the previous discussions we have several times evoked that we can have both 61B and 61F, as legal basis for our processing. The way it is presented is that we first go for 61B because it's a stronger point, or if I can say so, it's more strong as and it's serial, the processing, the the analysis that we are doing, as Thomas presented there. And if we arrive that we have 6.1b, we base ourselves in this legal basis, and then we go to 6.1f. It doesn't mean that we say that they cannot be both valid, but we start with the one which is a stronger basis. This is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Thomas, this is what we discuss also.
Great. Okay. I have Beth. Okay, as you wish, the two of you, please.
That's very sweet. Thank you, Beth. Thanks, Thomas. This is like a computer program for working through this. It's brilliant. How do you defend? Could we flick back one page?
Straight to the PowerPoint.
The pros. Thank you. Yeah, the one we. The Thomas's.
The Word document.
The document with the text.
Thanks. So 3B is a test. Based on a lawful ICANN requirement, how do you avoid the James Bladel argument that this could be a circular argument? How do you defend this test against that?
By conducting a proper legal analysis of the lawfulness. So the example that's been used earlier during this week is an ICANN requirement. You know, which technically wouldn't be necessary, as James said. You know, to know the data for every registrant is still a good requirement because I can service that you make that association of the domain name to the registrant. While unfettered publication of who is data is also an ICANN requirement, and we know that that's not a lawful requirement. So we have to look at the requirements on a case by case basis. And again, lawful in this sense is not only GDPR, it's all applicable laws. It's the Human Rights Charter, and particularly Article 8 can come into play there, so we have to take a quite holistic approach to that.
Thank you.
Me? Thank you for switching back. I actually have a question about this. So I do think that, shall I start over? I think that defining this as... evaluating this based on is a part of the service could be potentially problematic, but I do like that we're doing this in general, so I'm going to reserve that as a question because I think this is going to be super-duper valuable. I would say that I think it would make sense if we moved 6 up into the first section. I think it's important to identify who the parties involved in the processing activity are, and I think it very much helps us inform what the legitimate interest will be rather than looking at this all as, you know, we're starting with ICANN purposes. But at this point, you know, I think with this exercise, we're really looking at all of the parties and all the processing activity as it relates to all the parties involved in that activity, as opposed to, as we were before with the sheet saying it's an ICANN process purpose, it's a registry purpose. Now we're just looking at the processing activity and the parties involved.
I think you're making an excellent point, if I may, because that caused some confusion to take the purpose as a starting point. Without the concrete processing activity. And I think that, you know, we've been using the purpose matrix, or at least that was my idea when co-drafting it with Benedict, that we would take that as a basis for allocating responsibilities. Because typically the party that is involved in a certain processing activity to be conducted, the party that's interested in pursuing a certain purpose, is the one that will ultimately assume responsibility for that processing. You can move 6 up to 0 and answer that as the first question. I think what's important is that you really start with analyzing 6.1b and then move to 6.1f. But if you want to tackle the responsibility question first, that's perfectly fine.
Okay. In the queue, I have Hadia, I have Cavus, and Alan. Is that a fresh or is that an old one? Okay. So Hadia and then Cavus.
So, Hadja Minyai for the record. So my question is a little bit similar to what Beth was saying, because in the exercise that we were doing yesterday, and we have we had the ICANN purposes, and then solving for this, for example, for a certain purpose, putting it as an ICANN purpose, we might end up having the lawful purpose as an example, 6.1f. And then if we're solving the same purpose but from the point of but tackling it as an as a registry or registrar purpose, we could have the lawful basis as 61B. So for the same purpose, depending on for which one you're solving, you could have different lawful purposes.
Okay.
So for example, for the same purpose, you could have 61F if you're considering it as an ICANN purpose, and you could have 61B as the lawful purpose if you're considering it as a registrar purpose. And in the end, we still have one purpose with two identified lawful purposes. I mean, when we are compiling things together after we're done with the exercise, and then solving for ICANN, you have 61F, and then solving for the registrar, you have 61B. In the end, when you compile this, which lawful purpose would you refer to? I don't know if I can get my point through. It's I have the answer, by the way, but I just want to put it out there and hear from you.
Can we take first Caboose's question, and then let's circle back, because I think what Hadia is saying is relevant for how we want to be tackling the remaining work in this meeting, right? How we want to be sticking to ICANN purpose versus looking at it from the angle of registrar registry. Caboose, you've got the floor.
Yes, someone said that 6F is more stronger than 6E, therefore we could take 6F. That is not the case. They are overlapping in 6E and 6F, but there are elements in 6E talking about public interest, which is not in 6F. So if you want to take that, you have to take that part of dealing with the performing the task in for the public interest. So that is a very important element. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. I want to just jump in there because I think it was a problem with the sound in the microphone, because the comment was that 61B, as in boy, is stronger than 61F because F has a balancing requirement on the backhand, if I understood that correctly. So that was the comment. It was just about 61B, as in boy, being stronger than 61F because 61F has a balancing requirement. That was the comment.
Yeah. Excuse me. Maybe I misunderstood the people talking about 61F. Yes, 61B and 61F. I don't think that we should take the notion of which is the stronger and which is weaker. We should see whether there are some overlapping in 61B and 61F. If there is overlapping, we should take one of them, 61B for instance, and to see whether there is any element in 61F which is not in 61B. If we confirm that, therefore we can take 61B and not 61F. If we don't confirm that, we have to transfer part of the 61F, which is not currently either directly or indirectly, is 61B. I'm sorry, I am remote participation, and I cannot directly say what was discussed. But this is my view that we should be quite careful and not opting for a stronger or weaker. We talk about the substance. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks. And there's a lot of head nodding here, Caboose, supporting what you're saying, just to let you know. Okay. So I think we've reached where we need to get to in terms of understanding what that group has been going through in their process. And I think what, if I heard correctly, Thomas, the suggestion was, one, you know, it may be helpful to bump this, the look at who's the responsible party up to higher, higher in the conversation. Okay. In general, people found it a useful way of looking at processing activity and therefore determining lawful basis on that, a legal basis. Okay. Great. And then I think, Hadia, we should have a conversation. Maybe it doesn't need to be right now, But I feel like my proposal to everyone is let's stick ICANN-centric purpose, right? And let's see how far we get. And if we get to the end and we're like, oops, there's things here that's not enough, but let's for now just stick with that and we'll not do the mental exercise about who else has the same purpose and how that changes their lawful basis. Okay? Good. So we're sticking with ICANN purpose on that. All right. Now comes fun. B. So let's pull up, go back to the matrix here. So now our task is to take our this compromise language of purpose B, right? And it's up on the screen right now. Remember what it was? We rolled up a bunch of third-party issues, and we put them into the single purpose called facilitate lawful access. Oops, there's a 2 and a 4 there. I hope facilitate lawful access to legitimate or for legitimate. Help me out, guys. Facilitate lawful access for legitimate third-party interests to data that is already collected and identified herein. Okay? So, and Terry's passing out blank copies of this, too, that we'll use. Now, you can imagine that one of the dilemmas of doing this matrix in for B is that it may, and I just say may because I really don't know, it may be different in terms of the data collected, right, or anything else in this sheet may be different based on the type of legitimate third-party interest you're talking about. Right? We may have a different sheet if we're talking about a different kind of third-party interest or legitimate third-party interest, or we may not. So I want to just have everyone pause for 30 seconds, look at this blank sheet, or actually it's 1 minute. Look at that blank sheet and think individually for 1 minute. If you can get off your computers for a second, guys. Yeah? Jump off the computer for 1 second. Take that blank sheet. Look at it. Look at the purpose. And does it say 2 and 4 in the blank sheet that we just passed out? Okay, so pick a word. Pick your favorite word between 2 and 4 in the just where it says facilitate lawful access 2, 4. I think it's probably 4, right? Look at this sheet and think about how you would fill it out given that there are different types of legitimate third-party interest. So everybody take a minute, look at the sheet, think about it. How would you do this work if you were to go off in a group right now and try to fill out this sheet, this purpose? Let's take a minute individually, just think about it.
I think we're getting awfully caught up on the ICANN here, and what we talked about this morning and yesterday was not to get completely caught up on ICANN purposes and to look at sort of data processing activities and that kind of thing. And we did talk about this yesterday, and I think the sheets were meant to be updated, but I don't think this one has been.
No, indeed, it has been updated to reflect that question 3 really now is about the processing activity, right, and the responsible party. We are still keeping the frame of this is within our analysis of an ICANN purpose, OK?
because that's our mandate as this group is to understand what the purposes are. So I think one of the reflections we can have on this is when we attack this purpose and others, how much do we want to start by saying, let's look at the actual processing activities connected to this, right? Is that our step one question? Or is our step one question, do we need to distinguish between different kinds of legitimate business?
Lindsay, what were you expecting to see there in that box?
I was expecting it to be near the top.
So I'm seeing some hands go up, and I think this is, I mean, I gave you a little bit less than a minute. Sorry about that. But let's see. What did you think about when you say, how would we go about using this tool for analysis to make sure we're refining our purpose and understanding what we're saying here? So Beth, and then over here. And Fiona. Okay. Yeah.
To build off Lindsay's comment, and I think what we tried to say in the beginning before we started this, I would use our new Word document and start with who are the parties involved, and therefore it would not just be an ICANN purpose. It would be who are the parties involved, this is the purpose, and then these are the parties for which this is a legal basis. So I would actually just dissect this a little bit, kind of like you're diagramming a sentence. because I do think that looking at these from the ICANN purpose lens is just going to make us have to do this three times. And if we identify the parties and then the processing element for the processing element, we will then, the rest will shake out very naturally.
Let's build on those ideas and see if that's going to work for folks. Margie, Fiona?
As you try to fill this out, I think I'm confused because it says, for third-party interests identified herein, and so I'm not sure what that refers to, and it's hard to fill it out if you don't know what the identified herein does.
Yeah.
So I think it's something similar to what Beth is saying. You kind of need to identify what that is in order to answer the questions. Otherwise, we're kind of answering it in a vacuum.
Right. So exactly when that phrase was put in, the idea was there would be some reference to legitimate third-party interests elsewhere in the document. Right? That's why that herein was put in the purpose. Right? So that's as I understood it. So if others understood that differently, please chime in. Okay? So that, you know, part of our analysis might be, all right, what are we going to be mentioning herein? Okay. Great. Fiona?
Your question was if we look at this form, how would we work with this tool to be able to answer the question of looking at the different lawfulness of processing. And because those three areas are not exactly in tandem and they might pull in different ways, when you look at the issue of performance of a contract vis-a-vis the legitimate interests of third parties to access the information and the issue of consent, they don't necessarily work together. Because third parties may want the way they want to approach it may be very different. And you need to be able to, we still need to be able to protect the subjects in as far as that data is given. So if I was to use this, I would actually fill it three times with each document addressing one lawfulness for processing. So one document would have Article 6.1B and address all the issues in relation to that. That means we do it three times, like what Beth was suggesting.
So I'm not sure Beth was suggesting doing it based on, and she can't hear you right now, but I don't think Beth was suggesting doing it three times based on each potential lawful purpose. I think she was suggesting doing it based on the party and the processing activity, but Beth can correct that.
Okay. However, then my suggestion would be then we'd have to do it, I would do it three times so that then I'm able to capture everything uniformly and in the same way with all the other documents we've worked on so that it's easy for somebody who's not sat in this room to understand.
Okay, great. So Beth is going to help explain her initial suggestion, but basically she wanted to go use that logic that Thomas put up there, and that would necessarily look more at processing activities and parties, right, rather than just starting with a purpose. Margie's saying, let's identify what are those interests herein so we know what we're actually talking about here. And Fiona's saying, well, maybe we should go through by lawful basis, by the three lawful basis. Well, okay. Those are all interesting suggestions. Hadia, where's your mind on this?
Okay. It's a quick one, and I'm answering Marty. And I was thinking, you know, why do we need to identify the legitimate third party's interests here? Let's say we identified legitimate third parties, and we want to facilitate lawful access for them. That's the purpose. So why do you need to identify them here? Why do you need to see the third parties in here? It's not really within the purpose is, you know, facilitate lawful access to legitimate third party interests. That's the purpose. Somewhere else or someone else or identified those third parties, and we establish here that they are identified and they are legitimate. And so
your point is that the data analysis doesn't change for you based on which third-party interests we're talking about. It's the same data analysis for you. Okay. Caboose, you have your hand up. You've got the floor.
Yes, sorry, I don't really understand the situation. I don't understand either thing that why we have to identify the interest of third party. The interest of third party is important. I don't think that we should say 6B is stronger than 6F. In 6F clearly mentioned legitimate interest of the third party. And 6B does not talk about that directly. So they are not mutually exclusive. You have to take on board part of the 6B and put it in 6F. And now I agree with George's that I'm taking 6F as something. But I request you kindly, convince me if I'm wrong. Third-party interest, legitimate interest, is important element has been mentioned many times in the GDPR. And we should not say that will be identified by somebody. Who is that somebody? Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. All right. Looks like the queue has just, while I was on the floor, gone crazy. Okay. So I see Margie, Stephanie, Milton, and Alex, and Beth and Lindsay. Okay.
Sure. To answer Hadia's question, I think our answers are going to, for like the data elements and whether the processing is necessary to achieve the purpose, I think it's going to vary depending upon which third-party interest you're talking about. That's why I think you have to break it out by, you know, the ones that are identified herein, because I don't think it'll be the same answer for all three of them or however many we have. Thank you.
And the legal basis is also different, right?
Great. Okay, so the data could be different and the legal basis could be different. Yeah. Stephanie.
Thanks very much, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I'm very sorry. I'm very confused about what we're doing right now, and that's probably because I'm late, but my colleagues have been unable to elucidate matters for me. So I thought we were going back to the matrix that Farzi and Thomas had worked on, and I would just like to submit a suggestion that might help. We need definitions of terms, and people need to read them, because we are using them very loosely here, and it is adding to the confusion of an already somewhat recursive process. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Stephanie. And, you know, let's try to clarify that in just a second. Let's run around the queue here. Milton?
Yes, so I think I do know what we're doing. We're talking about B, and we are trying to fill out the matrix for B, are we not? So one thing I think I can clear up here is that Margie and others were talking about the word identified herein, as if it were the third-party interests. I think that's exactly what this is a good statement of the purpose, that it doesn't identify specific third-party interests. Those I agree with Hadia that there's no need to do that. But the herein is a reference to the data that is already collected, okay? That's what gets identified herein, okay? So the...
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I'm not done.
Yeah, no.
Okay,
no.
All right. So it's pretty clear from the English language there that interest to data that is already collected, and that was very important part of this compromise, was that we didn't like these expansive purposes or some of the different purposes precisely because they might justify all kinds of new collection. And we said, you know, we're willing to recognize these as an ICANN purpose if it just means that these legitimate interests get access to data that is already collected. So I think our problem of what the data elements are is pretty much solved. It's all the stuff that's already been collected under WHOIS, and we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on that. We just need to recognize the lawfulness questions and go through that, I hope.
Great. Okay. All right. Well, there's a lot of enthusiasm around that. Okay. Great. Beth, Lindsay, Benedict, yep.
What Milton said? I think
that's
that,
fine. You can
no.
say whatever Milton said. I
no,
agree.
I agree heartily with Milton. I will say, I think part of this, can I ask just to be annoying and put Thomas's
yes.
list up? Because I think if we're looking at the thing that we're supposed, the process we're supposed to be following, I think it will help us. Because I think one thing that is missing from this particular sheet is that we're basing this, briefly describe the processing activity. This is a purpose, not a processing activity. So what I think we need to do is maybe talk about what's the processing act, as Milton very much described. Yes.
Down in three, right?
Yeah, but I think we need to do that first, because why are we creating a purpose for something that we don't know what the activity is? So I think Milton described it really well. It's, you know, this is just legitimizing disclosures based upon we're collecting it for this purpose, yes, but the processing act is collection. So I think that if we have that, then we understand who the parties are. So I just wanted to clarify that and just maybe we guide ourselves with this as well as this.
Great. Okay. Lindsay?
Just wanted to echo what Milton said, because that was great. Instead of talking about processes, let's just get on with it.
Okay, great. Anybody else? Benedict, do you want to say something before we just get on with it?
Yep. Milton, the two data that is already collected begs the processing activity question. It's a logical fallacy. Can you think, and Stephanie has quite rightly told us, that we should be thinking of in terms of the processing activities. Can you think of a better, more elegant way to create the controls that you're concerned about without begging the question in the purpose? Thank you.
Want me to answer that?
Sure.
So offhand, I don't have any other alternative language. I suppose we could think about that, but I'm not sure why it begs the question. It is, we're facilitating lawful access. Now, if you're saying this is not a purpose, it's an access question, we totally agree with you. We didn't want it in there, but we made that concession because other stakeholder groups wanted it in there as a purpose of ICANN. So we said, okay, let's call it a purpose of ICANN so that you feel like you are getting a guarantee that you will get access to this data that's already collected. But I don't quite get the logical contradiction.
I think maybe that's something that you guys wanted the two of you take offline, unless others are extremely worried about it as well. So this is what I'm going to suggest, folks. I'm going to ask the team here if we can print out copies of this. Wow. Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go, as Lindsay says, let's go do it, right? We're going to use our matrix sheet, our worksheet, and we're going to be also using this set of questions that Thomas and the group have put together as a way of getting into this sheet, okay? And we're going to do that in smaller groups, and we're going to do it parallel, all answering the same things. And we're doing it in smaller groups because we've seen over the last 2 days that you guys are accelerating your pace in smaller groups, okay? So we're going to divide this time into three groups, I think, unless we want to try to do four. Let's do three groups, and we're going to do one right in here, and we're going to do we have those spaces available to us in the kitchen? Yeah? So we'll do group A here, group B in the kitchen on this floor, and group C in the kitchen upstairs. So what you want to do within your stakeholder groups, folks, is split yourself up, send a person to A, a person to B, and a person to C. If you have three, if you have more, you know, distribute as needed. If you have two, whichever you want. Okay, this is parallel work, right? We're all working on the same set of questions, and what we're sending you off to do is fill in this sheet, answer these guiding questions from Thomas, figure out what the lawful purpose is for the activities that are associated with this purpose, right? And we'll bring it back in and see how far you got, okay? We'll see how, you know, so this is the time, confer with your stakeholder group, divvy yourselves up. Group A is here. Group B is in the kitchen on this floor. Group C is upstairs. All right? And we'll be distributing ourselves in those different groups as well to help capture and take notes. And we'll do that. It's 11, almost 11:10 right now. Yeah.
Sorry, we're talking just specific to B. Is that right?
B. Now, B may have different processing activities, right? There are potentially different processing activities connected with B, but we are in B. Yeah, everybody's doing B. Okay, just different. Spread yourself out, folks. This is let's do this. Let's take an hour and see how far we get in 1 hour. Yep.
If we could, sorry.
Yeah.
Farzan is speaking. May I suggest we do not divide into groups?
No, you can suggest that, and we're still probably going to do it. I'm sorry. Okay? So we're dividing into three. We're going to have one in here, one in the kitchen, and one upstairs. Yeah. Wait. There's a question about how to self-select in your stakeholder group. Divide. That's all. Right? Divide in your stakeholder group. That's the only self-selection. There's no preference between A, B, and C, okay? The reason, just folks, the reason why we're doing it this way and we're doing the experiment is that there's been extremely strong evidence is this is the pathway to getting faster actual product, right? So we're in the product creation mode right now, so we're going to test that. We're going to test that theory. We're going to do it for an hour, and then we're going to see what happens. Okay. Beth and Christina?
So I just have a question. Well, if we do it this way,
yeah.
No, I say if. If we do it this way, are we the three groups, group one, two, and three, who are all working on the same thing? We're going to come back and then smoosh it together?
Yep.
So we're going to do it a fourth time.
Well,
okay.
We always do anyway. Right? Yeah, we always do anyway. We bring it back in. There's plenty to say. Let's run with this, folks. We're going to invest an hour in this and see how it goes. We're going to bring it back. Okay? So let's split up. Let's do A, B, and C. Okay? And divide yourselves up in your stakeholder group, right? Okay. Okay, folks. Let's go. So who's going to go upstairs to the... Okay. Kurt and Caitlin are going to lead people upstairs. Group C is going to go with Kurt and Caitlin upstairs, folks. Let's go ahead and do it.